True.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Bible study for Monday. This week, we're looking at roadmaps to reading the Bible. And before I start, let me just inquire, how many retired pastors do we have in the room? Oh, just one. Okay, all right. A refresher course. Yes. Oh, please. A refresher for you.
We'll interpret for you.
The premise of this week is that there are different kinds of writing in the Bible. And reading the Bible really is a little like reading the morning newspaper. Only we know how to read feature stories, and we know that they're not op-eds, and we know that they're not Dear Abby, and we automatically switch between all of these different modes of writing, unconsciously, because we've learned what to expect from each of them. And it's my thesis that if we can understand the various kinds of writing in the same way, it'll make it easier for us to make our way through the Bible. And in particular, I wrote a book that deals with the Old Testament, and I looked at six different kinds of writing: history, stories, prophecy, poetry, wisdom, and laws. And this week we'll get to look at five of those. Now, there's no magic key that unlocks the mysteries of the Bible, but I think this helps. I also have some general guidelines for listening to the Bible, and that's in an appendix in my book. This is not a pitch to try to sell you the book, because the bookstore's out of books, so you can't buy it anyway, but just to tell you what I'm working from. One thing that I like to do in Bible study is listen. Listen first, before we read. I think modern people get very text-oriented, but these were oral stories, told orally, passed down, and eventually committed to writing. So I have my characters lined up, and we're going to read you, this is just five verses from the book of Numbers. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Thus Israel yoked itself to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel. The Lord said to Moses,
"Take all the chiefs of the people and impale them in the sun before the Lord, in order that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel."
And Moses said to the judges of Israel,
"Each of you shall kill any of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor."
My sense is that one of the important guideposts for reading in the Bible is, how did that feel to you emotionally? What initial response did you have to that passage? We'll read it again and again, so you'll have more opportunities. Anybody?
Rather gruesome.
Rather gruesome. Yeah. In what way?
Well, not only killing, but impaling, which is a particularly...
Impaling them in the sun. Yeah. Gruesome. Okay. Other immediate responses to it.
Well, I was thinking of the Norwegian Vikings or the Norsemen, when they were back in their violent days, when they'd conquer someplace, mm-hmm. they'd throw the babies up in the air and let them see if they could impale them on their swords as they came back down. So it's not just Old Testament. It's, I mean, that was awful. Can't you just take that out of the Book of Numbers and put it someplace?
Yeah.
Sell it to the Norwegians.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, is this my kind, loving, forgiving God saying this?
Yeah.
Well, there's the quote from Mark Twain that the Old Testament was written before God got religion.
I hadn't known that. That's great. Yes, yes. Well, actually, in a way, that's true, because I know the Bible tells us that Yahweh came along, monotheism was implanted, with the Israelites were chosen, and they believed, and so history unfolded. And it was those heretics who believed, followed Baal or Peor or something. But in actual terms, probably historically, for the first 400 or 500 years of Israel's existence, they were working things out, and they were worshiping the Canaanite god El, who kind of converged with their tribal deity Yahweh. And then there was Asherah, who sometimes was seen as a consort of Yahweh and sometimes not, worship separate. So all of this was going on, and some of this warrior god stuff was accumulated from the Canaanites. So I'm not saying blame it on the pagans, because the Israelites appropriated this language. But in a way, yeah, while they were working out who God was, they borrowed from Canaanites. I mean, they probably were Canaanites themselves, but they were picking up these pieces. And there are places in the Old Testament where it's really sounds like exact descriptions of Baal or Anat or El or some of these other Canaanite deities. So Mark Twain hit it on the head, actually. Yeah. Anything else? We'll read it again, but before we...
Sort of tough love, in a sense.
Tough love.
Sometimes you have to say no to your children because you love them.
Okay.
And maybe God is saying, no, you can't do this type of thing because he wanted to keep them separate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You kind of have to forget about the impaling them in the sun to
very tough.
Very tough.
Yeah, very tough. Okay. Anyone else? Anything else? Yeah.
We kind of get this impression of a voice coming out of the clouds saying this, and I find myself thinking, did God really speak directly to those people? Were there people that were trying to find solutions in the religious community that felt that this is what they needed to do, and saying, God
made me do it.
God is saying, in my mind, this is what we have to take some drastic measures.
Yeah.
And it becomes credited to God saying, but what is the original source?
Yeah. That's a good point. I deal with that when I talk about histories, but briefly, I think you're onto something, because no one was there taking dictation. We don't even know if there was someone named Moses. I think the Exodus story is powerful. But were there 100,000 Israelites marching through the desert? The best archaeologists, Israeli and European, have not been able to find any of those kinds of traces. We have lots of other material remains of Israelites, but this wilderness journey, and that's still, there's a big question mark there. So I don't take it as fact. I do, however, take it as a truth, that there's a powerful truth in that liberation story. Factual, well, I'm not going to hold them to it. So some of these writings, yes, were by priests, by scribes, by royal historians much later, who were dealing with problems in their own era, but put it back into a previous era. So that's a longer conversation. But let's read it again and see what we get this time. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Thus Israel yoked itself to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel. The Lord said to Moses,
"Take all the chiefs of the people and impale them in the sun before the Lord, in order that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel."
And Moses said to the judges of Israel,
"Each of you shall kill any of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor."
Further thoughts?
Yes. First thought was that the people came there and they were having sexual relations with them. That shows what heterosexuals do. Okay. The second thing I thought was God... left me, but the horribleness of this, I don't believe that God would do such a thing.
You don't believe God would do such a thing? Yeah. Yes.
Well, it seems like Moses kind of turned the words around, because God said, impale the chiefs. And he said, no, let's get the people instead.
Oh, you have a good ear. That's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. We're going to dig deeper into that later. For now, I want to ask you, it's important to go through a passage and find out, are there words or phrases that you don't understand? They're at Shittim. Well, first of all, Israel, the context is important to know. And if you've been reading through Numbers, you know that the Israelites have been out in the wilderness for nearly 40 years. So this is a collective we're talking about. And Shittim was, no one's quite sure where it is, but in the narrative it seems that it's just outside of the promised land. They haven't crossed over the Jordan, but this is sort of a last stop. So this is after all these years, they're still dealing with these issues. Now, another piece is, do you notice it's the women of Moab, mm-hmm. women of Moab. Anyone remember?
Could you tell me what verse that is?
What verse that is?
Where you're at?
What chapter
verse?
Yes, in just a moment.
Was one of them named Ruth?
Yeah.
Was Ruth?
It's true. Ruth was a Moabite. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. What were you?
So much of the interpretation of the Bible is gender specific. When it said the people are having sexual relationship, maybe there was a couple of things.
You know what? This is the New Revised Standard Version, and I bet it says the men. But even the people, many times the people means male Israelites. Women are somehow outside of that. Even though women were included in the covenant, there's still this language that suggests the people are the male members of Israel. But I do like your suggestion.
It was a joke.
I thought that was a good joke. So Moabites, back to Moabites. Does anyone remember how we got Moabites?
Didn't Moses marry a Moabite?
That's also true. So this is very interesting. When Moses does something, it seems to be a little different than when the people. Moabites, remember Lot and his daughters escaping from Sodom? And then the daughters get anxious about whether or not they can continue the human race, because they think the world is, everyone else is dead. So they have sex with their father. And out of that liaison, one of the daughters, comes the Moabites. So you just say the word Moab or Moabite, and I think Old Testament audiences would have gone, you already know that there's something sexually a little strange about this, or that they're sexualized in some way. Mm-hmm. And Baal of Peor. Now, I'm giving you this information. If you have a good study Bible, it should be in the footnotes, or a one-volume Bible dictionary is really handy to have while you're working with these texts, because these little details mean something. But Baal was a Canaanite deity. He was the storm god, brought rain. And Peor, I guess that was associated with some particular geographic location. So it's a very specific manifestation of Baal. Were there any other, words or phrases that you didn't know what it was? Here's a little tidbit. It says that the fierce anger of the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel. That's actually in the Hebrew, God's nose got hot. God's nose got hot. It's very physical. The Hebrew is very physical. Yeah. Okay, here's the secret. Numbers 25, verses 1 through 5, if you want to look at it in your text. I do want to point out that this story seems to continue into the next several verses. But in fact, it's we've got two stories glommed together, which is why I just want us to read this, the verses 1 through 5. As you probably know, the Old Testament, you get a lot of different strands woven together, and this was a place where two different traditions got stuck together. So we're just looking at one distinct story. Let's try reading it one more time, and if you want to read along with us. God and Moses, are you okay with the another reading? Okay. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Thus Israel yoked itself to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel. The Lord said to Moses,
"Take all the chiefs of the people and impale them in the sun before the Lord, in order that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel."
And Moses said to the judges of Israel,
"Each of you shall kill any of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor."
Good. Thank you. What I'd like to do is go through this using some techniques of literary analysis, because this is a story. It has all the elements that stories have. Generally, there are four characteristics of a story. You've got the narrator. And you've got characters in the story. You've got a plot. And you've got time and space in a story. So I like freeform explorations of scripture. I also think that when you use these techniques, you get even deeper into it. And what I find is that usually I arrive at even more profound meanings when I do use these techniques. But even more so, it feels like I get inside the text in a way, and I can walk around thinking about it in my head, so that it's a deeper experience, a richer experience for me. So I hope for you too. The narrator is the voice of the story, and narrators have a point of view, and it's not explicit, it's explicit, you know, it's there. And the point of view shifts in the Bible, because there's a tension in the Old Testament between the royal theology and the liberation theology. There's a push and pull between the prophetic vision and how that prophetic vision was used by the imperial powers, the actual imperial powers. So how does the narrator sound to you in this, in Numbers 25? Does the narrator comment or make a judgment about God's command?
Just reports it.
Just reports it. Does that make the narrator neutral?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. What do you think? Whose side is the narrator on? Can we know that? He's telling the story, yeah.
It's kind of an establishment voice.
An establishment voice.
When we think of later, the story of Ruth, in which a Moabite is lifted up as an example of faith, that's a different point of view, prophetic point of view, different from this one.
Yeah, up from the bottom. So more establishment. Anybody, another perspective on that?
I thought it was like a newscaster.
A newscaster.
Yeah.
Just reporting, just the facts, just reporting.
Yeah, well, that's usually more the establishment point of view.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the story of the narrator seem to blame the people, not the manager.
Ah, blame the people.
Not the high Moses and his elders.
The narrator seems to know about God's anger and therefore knows about the Israel's beliefs and religion.
Yes, yes, all of that is assumed, isn't it? Good, good points, good points, yeah.
Well, in the rest of the chapter, nowhere apparently do the judges or the chiefs of the people get impaled. It's only one couple.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's a completely different story from something else, but it just gets stuck on there. So it doesn't necessarily reflect back on what was happening in these five verses. Yeah, I mean, they wanted, the final editors wanted it to say something, but there's really a bit of a disjointure there. Larry, did you want to say something?
The person who's telling the story, I think, seems to think he knows what God wants.
Seems to think.
I think the narrator, too, there's the one verse that I kind of resonate to is that verse 4 says, the chiefs of the people and impale them in the sun before the Lord in order that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. That there's anger there, but that anger can turn away and the people have some freedom, you know, to through this story to look at where are they, you know, where are they kind of getting all turned off from God towards the Baal, you know, and that's death, you know, it's this kind of this theme of death and life that's through the Old Testament, choose life, you know, that's the only bright light in that passage for me. I think the narrator is trying to get at that.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I guess I was sort of thinking it was more like appeasement. Let's find the right formula for how to make God not be angry with us, rather than actually looking at, isn't this just a symptom of what's perhaps of how we aren't really in how we aren't really following God? Isn't just, you know, having it isn't just these 10 people. Maybe it's all of us, it's the community, and we need to look as a community. Instead, let's see who we can blame and punish them.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
In fact, if that last half of that verse wasn't in here, it'd all just be judgment and bad.
Ah, okay, interesting. Well, you know what, we're segueing into characters, because now we're starting to describe the character of God. And God is very an explicit character in this passage. Sometimes God is just in the background, but that's what the Old Testament is really a narrative about God, even though it's talking about Moses and Aaron and Miriam and other people. So how is the character of God presented?
He's, what's the fancy word, anthropocentric. God is a man with a loud voice.
Yeah.
And I think the narrator has a bias, and it's a very modern criticism of how you read the news or hear the news, depending on what your bias is. You want to see that bias in any story that's reported.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big argument going on today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good point. Yeah. And the narrator is biased in which way?
He's biased to the survival of Israel.
Okay. I think that's very important. Biased to the survival of Israel. Yeah. Yeah.
They're not going to be swallowed up by another culture, by other deities.
Okay.
My God's not going to allow that. My God's bigger than your God, and we're going to get you.
Now, that's interesting. My God's bigger than your God. This is a transitional point, actually, in development of religion, where you say, well, we have exclusive worship of our God. There are these other gods, but ours is better than. Yeah. So it's not strict monotheism.
Hmm.
It could be revealing that. Okay, so how does God come across, or Yahweh, because where you see the little Lord, that's actually, well, it's a long story how we got there, but that's actually Yahweh, which was the tribal God brought from the south into Israel.
His nose is out of joint.
So we've got this very human-sounding God whose nose gets red, hot, strong passions.
He's angry and jealous.
Angry and jealous.
Very violent.
Violent. Okay. Other thoughts about God? Someone pointed out, though, it does, you know, God can be appeased, so God isn't just angry and violent. But God needs to be appeased, apparently. How about Moses? What do you think of Moses?
Is Moses disobeying God's instruction?
Well, this is really interesting. What's the difference between what God says and what Moses orders? Just so we're clear on that. What does God say to do?
God says to punish the people.
Chiefs of the people. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's
Moses.
Yeah. So it's the people have gone, literally, it's the whoring with the Moabites in Hebrew. So, but God gets mad at the chiefs. Why do you think that would be? What's God responding to?
Seems to me the judges would be the chiefs of the people.
That the judges would be the chiefs?
But they're not. The judges, Moses asked the judges to act.
Yes, interesting.
Maybe they were the perpetrators at the beginning of it.
We don't know who started this. So.
Is it the chiefs of the Israeli people or the chief of the Moabites?
It's the chiefs of the clans of Israel.
Chiefs of the clans of Israel. How I would take it.
And God says the chiefs, you know, they're kind of in charge.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And either you're going to be in charge or you're not going to be in charge. And by gosh, if your people start fooling around, it's your responsibility. It's your head.
But Moses... You know, the chief, the CEO of the Israelites, Moses, says something different. Take any of the people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor. What difference does that make within a community or a group?
Gets the judges off the hook.
Gets the judges off the hook. Aha.
But if you're made to kill someone, which I serve them, that can be a worse punishment than being killed.
Ooh.
A long-term punishment.
Ooh.
So those people, maybe Moses did punish those people that he was supposed to punish by having them kill people that would be on their conscience and responsibility for the rest of their lives.
Mm.
And maybe they... After that, they did a better job.
Very interesting point. Very interesting point. That you're suggesting that it's hard to kill, even though it seems like...
When there's repercussions.
Yeah, there's repercussions for the people who kill. Interesting.
Yeah, it raises another question. How do you determine that they yoked themselves to the Baal? You know, what's the difference? Or, you know, what is that? How thoroughly is it? Are they yoked? Or what is that? Do they completely disregard Yahweh? I'm not sure.
Well, let's look at the plot more closely and see what we've got. Because where does this start out? The people began to have sexual relations. It literally says to prostitute themselves with or to go whoring with. The people of the women of Moab. Okay, so the plot starts out where, as someone said, hey, they were doing what heterosexuals do. You know, they were getting together.
The women must have been very angry.
Yeah, I was just going to bring up the women. Where are the women of Israel in this? And were they making time with the men of Moab?
Never.
Well, the narrator seems to think not.
Right.
This is a continuing theme throughout Old Testament stories involving women. It's the women are the sexual seductresses, and they're the ones who lead men astray. You'll see this in stories again and again. It's the blame the women. So, but they start to have sex with the women. Well, I think you can have sex with someone without worshiping their God, but what happens? What's the next step? They go from having sex, and what it is, the women don't just seduce them into having sex, they also seduce them.
They invite
them. Yes, they invite people to sacrifices. It's, you know, if you look at the verbs, it's real helpful here. Okay, so the people were prostituting with the women. The women invited, the people ate, and then the people bowed down. That's sort of an interesting sequence, isn't it? Sex, maybe there was an invitation for the sex, too. Sex, invite, ate, bowed down. Why is eating important here? And we know this from the New Testament.
Socializing,
yes.
Community.
It's community.
Hospitality. But what was the food? Remember Paul talks about food offered to idols? Yeah, because the food would have been offered to idols. So if you eat that, then you're participating in this ritual, which is why Jews were exempt under the Romans in the New Testament times from having to participate in these civic feasts because the food would have been offered to idols and the Jews were grandfathered in. So here they ate and then they bowed down. So one thing led to another according to the narrator. Does that sound plausible to you?
No, it doesn't make any sense. I mean,
no?
Go from sex to eating to bowing down before another's gods. There's no agency whatsoever. The people appear to be completely under the control of the Moabites.
Sheep.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But ancient scripture almost always relates sexuality and spirituality, and that will continue even up into Paul's letter to the Romans, where sexual relations lead them to idolatry. So there's something evidently in the human psyche or whatever that we put sex and spirit together, and we also always put eating in there. I mean, communion in one form or another is always a religious ritual.
This is so interesting. I hadn't connected all of those pieces: sex, spirituality, and the food or eating.
They're life forces.
Life forces. Very interesting.
And do we know how long of a period of time that verse took place over? Because it could be years in which this transformation from being good to being bad took place.
Yeah.
Versus one day, for example.
That's when time and space become important, and the Bible is really very vague generally about this. Now we know where the place is, Shittim, so somehow that's important, that it was at the end of their journey and before they moved into Canaan. But time is very elastic. It could be days. It makes it sound like days. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And in fact, the Bible moves at breakneck speed. I know when you're reading the Begats, it feels like it goes on forever. But really, it moves It moves. It doesn't have all that detail that modern novels do.
Well, if this took place over several years, it's probably easier to believe that they did actually bow down to their to these other gods.
Okay, so
if
then it
took
becomes
place in one day.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So time really is important, and we don't really know that. It's not really specified.
Yeah.
Sex and hunger aren't necessarily separate. Good point. Good point. So the plot, plot usually hinges on conflict. Every story, there's some conflict. And there's the development of this conflict, and then there's some kind of crisis or turning point, and then there's a resolution. And in this story, you've got the development goes bing, 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 which sounds implausible to us, but apparently plausible to the audience at the time. So most of the focus is on that turning point, the crisis, and what is that? It's God and Moses. So do you see how very little is on the development? The Lord's anger was kindled against Israel. And then the plot develops that God makes a command and Moses modifies it. And we don't really know what happens because another story gets juxtaposed and it's just a man and a woman who get killed. But if you look at verse 10, it refers to that story, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back by wrath from the Israelites by manifesting such zeal among them on my behalf that in my jealousy I did not consume the Israelites. This is okay. You know what? I'm going to do something that I didn't think about before. Let's read verses 6 to 10. Because I can see now that the plot is developing in a different way. We've got God very angry and he wants the chiefs killed. Moses wants the people who had actually gotten down with Baal Peor. But then the editor stuck this other story in. Would someone like to read verse 6?
Just then one of the Israelites came and brought a Midianite woman into his family in the sight of Moses and in sight of the whole congregation of the Israelites while they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Okay.
7, do you want to read? Verse 7?
Sure. When Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he got up and left the congregation. Taking a spear in his hand, he went after the Israelite man into the tent and pierced the two of them, the Israelite and the woman, through the belly. So the plague was stopped among the people of Israel.
9.
Nevertheless, those that died by the plague were 24,000.
And then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the Israelites by manifesting such zeal among them on my behalf that in my jealousy I did not consume the Israelites. Therefore, say, I hereby grant him my covenant of peace. It shall be for him and for his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the Israelites. So where does this plot go? We've got God with his hot nose ordering the chiefs to be killed, Moses ordering the people to be killed, but then it veers off into another direction. The editor put this other story. What actually happens? Are the chiefs killed?
No.
Are the people killed?
No.
Who's killed?
the people who are doing the wrong.
Yeah, actually one man and one woman who are apparently having sex. And then this plague, so the plague was stopped. What plague?
24,000.
And 24,000 were killed.
And what's a Midianite?
A Midianite. Yeah, we started out with Moabite women, and now we've got Midianite women. See how these stories don't quite dovetail? Let me suggest that a couple things are going on, and these are the mysteries of the Bible that I love. My book I talk about. Did anybody here read Nancy Drew growing up? Remember Nancy Drew? Yeah, and her mysteries, you know, with her chump, she'd jump into her speedy roadster. And I always feel it's like doing detective work, you know. You interrogate the characters. You try to find out what happened when and who was where when. And then you put it all together, and it's like Nancy Drew. So we don't know where this plague came from, except we have this separate story. So I think there were two things going on. By putting that story of the couple who were killed in after this really violent order from Yahweh, what does that do? Instead of the people who were yoked being killed, you have this one couple.
There's a many.
Yeah, sacrificial lamb almost.
Yeah, so how does that then reflect back on God? Because God says, oh, okay, well, you know, this is taken care of, the tab's been paid. Does God come out looking quite so violent?
He becomes a little bit forgiving.
A little bit forgiving.
He affirmed what Moses said, even though it was different from what God apparently said.
Yeah.
It seems to me the suggestion, though, is that God has already killed 24,000 people by virtue of plague.
Yeah, so there's this plague that gets in here. So this is a little bit muddied. So on the one hand, we don't have the people impaled in the sun. But we do have a plague that apparently God...
This same story is repeated many times in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
With different characters and different times.
Different occasions, right? Yeah. Yes.
I was just going to say, it almost seems like God is waiting for at least one person to stand up for what is right. I mean, it's pretty rash, I guess, pretty big deal. It's a different world than what we live in, nailing a couple through the stomach. But, is anyone going to stand up for, you know, right? Hmm. And then he and his family was blessed with the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
good. Yeah, Judy.
I somehow can't help but think this is somehow related to how close they are to the Promised Land. But I'm not quite, you know, is it that they have to go through one more step of being ready to be there and being truly faithful and that they aren't yet? Or I don't really know, but it seems it can't be an accident.
Yes, I think you're onto something there. And I think you'd have to step back and kind of look at the whole couple of chapters and how it develops. Because it does seem repetitious. You know, the people keep doing this and getting into trouble, God gets mad, something happens, and then, you know, we're back to equilibrium.
Isn't that much like our Christian lives? At least mine?
Would anyone like to speak to that? I suspect that's one of the reasons this resonates. That's a very good point. And yet we still are left with this very vengeful, violent deity who wants blood in order to be appeased.
Read the New Testament.
And by that you mean?
The salvation of Jesus.
And if you say that Jesus died because God needed to be, you know, wanted a blood atonement.
God tried many other plans.
Mm. All right. I do want to, what, did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. I do want to make a point, and that is that the second story, okay, notice how it's a son of Aaron who does the act, yeah, mm-hmm, and then gets blessed with the priesthood forever. Okay, the first little piece that we read was from a tradition of the Yahwehs, the same folks who wrote the Adam and Eve story, where God is very anthropomorphic, walks in the garden in the cool of the evening. Here, God's nose gets hot. God is right there speaking to Moses. The second part comes from a strand, probably the priestly writers who did the first Genesis story. And there's speculation that this was a group of priests who traced their ancestry back to Aaron. So there was this political tension between these different priesthoods. And when this was put together at the time, there was tension between these different traditions of priesthood. And the Aaronic priesthood was editing this and wanted to make sure that everyone knew that really Aaron was the one who was blessed with priesthood. So a lot is going on in here that doesn't really have anything to do necessarily with the people of Israel or God. There, if things seem at cross purposes, they are. They are. There's a lot going on.
The cause of the plague is at the end of the chapter.
Okay, and what does it tell us?
The plague resulted from Peor.
From what?
Did God do that? I mean, this whole first paragraph.
Yeah, it gets woven back into the story of Baal and Peor.
Together.
Yeah, it gets all tied together, even though we're still with these Midianite women when we started out with the Moabite women. Yeah.
But then the people who sacrificed, or whose lives were sacrificed, it gives their lineage. The name of the slain Israelite man, uh-huh, the name of the slain woman, both come from lofty elite families.
Uh-huh. An ancestral house in Midian. Hmm. Midian. Did Moses marry a Midianite woman?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. See, this other priesthood traced their ancestry to Midian, this Mosaic tradition. Hmm. So some of this is the Aaronite priesthood saying Moses has this tainted history. You know, there's nowhere that the tradition that Aaron was a brother of Moses, that comes out of one particular tradition, not others. And it's like Aaron gets shoved into the picture for every photo op beside Moses to show, look, I was there at the beginning. I deserve the status of Moses, too. Very interesting. But I'm
this
still...
Is the same time period that Moses married a Midianite woman?
Same time period? No. I think by the story in the text was earlier, much, much earlier. But he married all kinds of women into the tribe. Yeah, I think there was a Cushite woman. I can't quite remember.
Mm. It's also interesting that Moses' wife's father is a priest of Midian.
Yes.
So she would have been, she wasn't just any old Midianite. She was also from a priestly family of a different ethnic group.
Yes, and where'd you find that, in Exodus?
Exodus 2, 11.
Oh, okay, that's when he goes off.
He goes off after killing the Egyptian.
He runs off to Midian. Yeah, and there's sort of the people who write about the history of God that I was speaking of earlier, you know, how did this whole notion about Yahweh develop? And think that maybe it actually comes out of some of this southern Midian tradition that Moses actually got it from the Midianites. We don't really know. But we're still left with this portrait of God. Any thought? Well, what questions still stay with you from this story?
God is bigger than my understanding of him.
God is bigger. What leads you to say that?
Well, it's kind of a phrase I found in archaeological dig out of my backyard, getting rid of moles. I come up with these little scraps of paper, I call them from the Bible, Book of Noah. Book of Noah.
Book of Noah.
And the big idea that all I end up with is I just don't understand this. You put it in a context of history, and you need the priestly line, and the Yahweh line. And I remember from seminary days studying the different strains of thought that are grouped together in the Old Testament writings. And I was raised in a setting where the Bible came down in a golden box of heaven, just like it is. And to try to sort all this out, unless I want to do a real thorough historical analysis like you are doing, I've never been that intricately into it. But I really appreciate how you're walking us through this. And I'm wondering here,
but God,
you have all these opinions about how God acts. And I remember Flip Wilson, one of his routines, he said, the devil made me do it.
Right.
Yeah. How much inside of me that resonates with how these people behave?
Yes, okay.
And you put that in the context of people in history, the lower status of women, something just above the animal world. Probably in this context. And then you get the implication here that the women are also a part of this bias. There's a big gender issue here.
Yeah.
And you try to tie that all together, and you take care of it, God, I'm going to go to sleep.
Okay. Well, I think that can be a good pastoral response. Just don't worry about the details.
With all our faith and, all our study and work and all this turns out to be chaff in the wind because we have to rely on the faith of God and our faith in God.
Okay.
Right. Even though we are curious animals.
Okay. All right. Larry,
I think there are always pendulum swings in the biblical story. And this is part of one of those pendulum swings that's part of, for example, that tradition comes out of Ezra and Nehemiah, where God has to be exclusive. People have to be exclusive for Israel to reconstitute itself as God's people. But then, in contrast to that, then you get the story of Ruth as the inclusive God coming out after that. So you've got exclusive, inclusive. Exclusive, inclusive. And in some ways it depends on where we are in our own journey, how we've got to kind of perceive these stories and how they influence us. There are times when perhaps in our own way somehow we have to be exclusive of certain things. But then we've got to see the inclusive God, how we go too far in that direction.
Good. Helpful. Someone else. Yes.
This is a question. I don't know the answer. In the ancient writings of Zoroaster about Zarathustra and so forth, is that written like a lot of stories, or is it less detail?
The Zoroastrian, what was finally written down, I think, are more like sayings and teachings, and less stories. That's my understanding. Any other final thoughts about what you take from this story?
I think it's important, however, that we have discussions like this about Scripture, because even though the story can be confusing, at the same time, there are certain patterns of thinking that we pick up from. And so we still are susceptible to talk. To think in this way about evildoers, and war is the answer, and killing is the answer, and it's often, often in our contemporary politics, we have echoes of this kind of stuff, and if we're not attuned to, in my theology, that Jesus Christ is the Word of God, not this book, That we judge by the God, the loving God revealed through Christ, which is somewhat different than this.
Mm. Good point. Anyone else?
I keep looking for reconciliation. Uh-huh. There's such an opportunity for, let's discuss this. You know, amongst these people, was there any historical bias towards forgiveness, reconciliation? These main New Testament themes, I know, are all through the Old Testament.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just my bias looking for those. Did these people even think that maybe there's some kind of reconciliation here other than violence?
Ah, that is a perfect introduction to previews of coming attractions. Thank you. Tomorrow, we're going to look at laws. I mean, Leviticus? Whoever reads Leviticus anymore? But the laws, yes, I think the whole holiness system and the sacrifice system, I think that was an alternative. It provided a means for people to offer something to God that wasn't human flesh and to get them right with God again. So that's all I'm going to say now, but I think the laws really show us what was important to Israel and what mattered and how their society functioned for good or bad. We're going to talk about a lot of interesting topics tomorrow. So thank you all very much for your participation. This was fun. I hope I see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.